When people are starting a business or a construction project, one of the biggest problems they face is how hard it is to get financing. USDA rural development loans make it easier to get financing for projects in areas with a population of less than 50,000 people. In that regard, rural development loans are another economic development incentive in the rural development toolkit. Welcome to Bring Back the Bustle, a podcast about revitalizing rural America. I'm Siobhan Jones, your host. Today, we're going to cover the ins and outs of rural development loans, how to get one, what they cost, what they can be used for, how using these loans impacts the amount of money that investors need to put in, and how the loans affect our return on that investment. It's a lot, and it's heady, but I do these kinds of episodes so that you can understand why an investment in the rural fund makes sense, the many ways that the law favors what we're doing and helps us succeed. As you're listening today, just try to understand the broad concepts. You don't need to understand this stuff well enough to become a practitioner. And then next week, we'll talk about something less technical and more about our impact on society. I like to alternate between the technical and the cultural and societal topics to give the podcast some balance. But today, let's talk about money, rural development loans. Where do babies come from? Where do rural development loans come from? You see, you were already going to sleep, and I had to wake you back up. Rural development loans don't come from the government, surprisingly. They come from participating banks, including some banks that aren't located in rural areas. That's great for us, because it means if you already have a relationship with a lender, someone who already has information about you and a credit history with you, that lender may be able to make your rural development loan. I used to think that rural development funding was dirt cheap. It really isn't, but it is available if you meet the lending criteria. The cost of this funding and the lending criteria directly impact our return on investment. So let's talk about cost and criteria. And that's almost redundant because complying with criteria is a cost. So you have monetary cost and you have compliance cost. Monetary cost. Rural development loans carry about 3 to 3.5% in loan origination fees. Now that's not the interest rate, those are your loan origination fees. And about 0.5% in annual guarantee fees. These annual fees are like PMI that you may have had on your loan, on your home loan. And that's in addition to the interest rate, which is a part of the cost of the loan. Historically, the interest rate runs about 3%, but it's been running a little bit higher since 2022 when the Fed began increasing interest rates due to inflation. So to summarize, you're looking at about 3.5% upfront, which you can add to your principal and finance. You can finance the origination fees. And then you're looking at another 3.5% or so in terms of your rate that you're going to carry for the term of the loan. Combined, that's about 7% or so in loan financial costs. In terms of loan size, there aren't any hard caps, but there are additional administrative requirements for loans where the guarantee portion exceeds $1 million. So if the government could possibly be on the hook for more than $1 million, the bank is required to dig deeper, and that means additional red tape. If the guaranteed portion is less than $600,000, on the other hand, the review process is somewhat truncated. Also affecting loan size are the size of the project. For example, a construction project can receive a loan of up to 100% of the prospective value. That's uncommon, but it's possible. Another factor is the borrower's debt to equity ratio. It can't fall below 4 to 1. So those are some factors that can constrain the size of the loan. but these constraints are different from hard caps that exist in other government loan programs that we'll discuss later in the season, not today. The government's overall budget for rural development loans for for-profit companies is $3.5 billion for fiscal 2025, which just began this fall. I mentioned some red tape, so let's talk about the red tape. Here's an important distinction. The government doesn't guarantee the loan. It guarantees part of the loss. That may sound like splitting hairs, but it's actually important because it means that the bank is going to lose some money if the loan isn't fully repaid. Let me give you an example. Let's say the loan is $100 and the government issues a loan guarantee of 80% of the loss. Now, let's say you, the borrower, pay back $50 before you default. At that point, when you default, the bank is fully covered, right? Wrong, because the government didn't guarantee 80% of the loan. It didn't guarantee $80. It guaranteed 80% of the loss. Here, the loss is $50. And so the government is only going to pay the bank back $40. The bank is going to lose $10 in this instance. And because the bank is guaranteed to lose something on every one of these loans that it writes, it's going to undertake a normal application review process. It's not going to make a loan with a guarantee that it wouldn't make without the guarantee, except to the extent that the government rules are different. The government standards in many ways differ from ordinary standards. Okay, what do I mean by all of that? I'm going to have to go into some detail. What I mean by that is that the rural development statute has some criteria in it that differ from banks' usual criteria. I don't have to get too far into the weeds, but I will point out the differences that apply to rural development loans, the ones that we care about. I'll point those out. Rural development loans require jobs analysis. So generally, you need to create jobs, and the loan can't result in substantial job losses, nor can it cause jobs to be moved from a rural area to an urban or other area. You see how that's different from normal loans? Normally, a bank doesn't care if you terminate jobs when you take money. They just care if you're going to be able to repay the loan. With rural development loans, we do care if you're going to terminate jobs. We do care whether jobs are being created or not. Also, when a business gets a loan, any business gets any loan, it needs to show equity on its balance sheet. And for rural development loans, the balance sheet equity requirements are lower. So that's good for us. That means that projects can qualify for a loan earlier if they're rural projects than they would otherwise be able to qualify for a loan. Plus, we get to use other economic development incentives to meet our already reduced balance sheet requirements. That's why it's so important to stack incentives. That's why we play the incentives game, because if you get one incentive, you can use that incentive to get other incentives. And before you know it, most of your money is incentive money. In fact, even subordinate debt can sometimes be used as equity for rural development loans. So we can get a loan from someone else and then use that as equity on our balance sheet for a rural development loan. So there are some special factors with rural development loans, special criteria that make them easier for people to qualify for than ordinary bank loans. Plus, rural development loans help us to avoid capital calls. What's a capital call? That's a new term, right? If you've invested privately before, your paperwork likely explained the circumstances under which your fund would ask you for more money. That's called a capital call. We don't have capital calls here, so you can rest easily. Because one reason we don't is because we can use rural development loan proceeds to buy out executive shareholders, not passive shareholders like you, but executive shareholders like me. this matters to you as well, because if I leave, and this is just a hypothetical because I'm all in, I'm not going anyplace, but if one of the other co-founders leaves, we don't have to do a capital call to buy them out. We can borrow the money through a rural development loan to buy that executive out. So that's pretty cool for those of you who are familiar with private investing. You'll be happy to know that there aren't any capital calls. That's another distinction between the rural fund and other private investments. We don't have capital calls. There are use restrictions on rural development loans, but none of them apply to us, not to what we do here at the Rural Fund. Plus, there are some things that we can do with a rural development loan that we can't do with many other incentives. So we can acquire property with a rural development loan. Can't do that with historic tax credits, for example. We can also use rural development loans for working capital, including payroll and inventory. We can refinance most other debt using a rural development loan. We can use a rural development loan for construction or equipment and machinery. So rural development loans help fill in gaps in places where we'd otherwise need investor capital. Now, of course, if we take a loan, any loan, rural development or otherwise, the fund must repay it. And although investors have no personal responsibility for the loan, the fund's balance sheet value decreases whenever we add debt to it. And if the fund's balance sheet goes down, the value of your shares goes down. If you've downloaded our investor guide, and it's called An Investor's Journey from Entry to Exit, that will show you how the value of shares fluctuates based upon activities of the fund, such as borrowing, or which causes it to go down, or economic development incentives or grants, which cause the value of your shares to go up. But back to rural development loans, are they worth the effort? Because I just gave you a lot of background on criterion. We've only scratched the surface, though, of the application process for a rural development loan. It's much more complicated than I've described. In fact, there's a scoring system for applications. But even with all the red tape, at the Rural Fund, we compare the cost of rural development funding in both money and time spent navigating the system to what it costs to raise private capital, because that's not free either. Private capital requires marketing. We have to find investors, right? It requires legal fees to prepare contracts and ensure compliance with the law. And after making the comparison between what it costs to raise private capital and what it costs to apply for rural development money, we've determined that rural development money is worth pursuing along with pursuing private investors, especially since we serve very small communities at the Rural Fund. And the smaller the rural community that you're going to serve, the higher your rural development loan application score can be. So you're much more likely to be approved for the rural development loan if it's for a smaller community like the ones we serve. Still, rural development isn't the first place to get money due to all the paperwork required and the soft costs that must be incurred to satisfy lending criteria. So we favor rural development loans for working capital, to pay off construction loans, or as an emergency source of funding to avoid capital calls on our investors. And we may use it for projects when we have many, many assets on our books. But in the beginning, we favor other sources of financing. So I've said a lot. Let's put all of that together. Rural development loans, in a nutshell, they are lowish rate, long-term loans. The term can be up to 40 years. I'm pretty sure I didn't mention that earlier. So they're long-term loans. They have relaxed equity requirements. They have generous debt to equity ratios, but they also have lots of red tape. They come from private U.S. lenders for projects in rural areas, and there's no cap on how much you can get. And although there are some restrictions on what they can be used for, none of what we do here at the Rural Fund is subject to those restrictions. There are other government loan programs that we'll look at and compare to rural development loans in a later episode. We're done with this for today. But at the end of the day, we still think rural development loans are worth the effort. So let's put rural development loans in context with the other incentives that we've already covered on Bring Back the Bustle. Because we're in episode 9 of the series. We've discussed many topics, some monetary and some cultural and society. Today was a monetary episode, so we're going to go back and recap the incentives, the monetary incentives we've covered so far in the program. Because as I've said many times, rural development is all about incentives. They make rural revitalization possible because they make it profitable. The first incentive we discussed is the patriarch of rural incentives, rural opportunity zones. They were first passed in the Beautiful Bill. That, so far, that episode is the most listened to episode that we've had. So I know you guys are aware of it, but I'm providing a link here. If you're listening to this on the website, you see a link where you can go back and re-listen to that episode if you wish. For those of you who are listening in your car or someplace, that episode, if you want to scroll back and listen to it again, is called The Old BBBA Got Opportunity Zones Almost Right. And it's the second episode in the series. The big benefit of opportunity zones is tax-free appreciation. Ding! Remember that? You get to park your money, let it grow, and then take your money out tax-free. That's better than a 401k plan, because a 401k just defers your taxes until you retire or reach mandatory withdrawal age when you must take money out and pay taxes. By comparison, opportunity zones eliminate your taxes altogether. The second incentive we talked about was historic tax credits. Historic tax credits basically shift the cost of constructing or rehabbing historic properties from the owner of the property to the taxpayers. Historic tax credits do this by giving us money we can use to pay our federal and state income taxes. And the third incentive is the one we covered today, rural development loans. This is flexible cash that can be used for acquisition, development, or even working capital. It has a slightly below market interest rate, although it does have a fee similar to PMI associated with it. Now, let's look at the combined effect of these three incentives. We tax professionals call combining incentives stacking. If you stack opportunity zone benefits, historic tax credits, and rural development loans, here's what you get. You get to borrow more money than your balance sheet would otherwise support through the rural development program. You get to use your historic tax credits to pay your income tax on your new business. And when your property increases in value because of the rehabilitation that you received historic tax credits to complete, and when your business that you're running generates a profit, which, by the way, is augmented because you didn't pay any taxes on it because of the historic tax credits you just got, when all of that happens, you can use the opportunity zone rules to take all of the appreciation and profit out tax-free. That's what the stacking accomplishes. Easy peasy, right? Well, actually, it's a great deal of work, but it's work that we do for you while you sit back and make tax-free money. That's why we do this podcast, because without an explanation, it would all seem too good to be true. So I explain all the incentives and our location strategy so that you can see that even though it's a great deal, it's also true. Now, this stuff can be pretty complicated. It's heady. I realize that. So that's enough for today. And next week, we're going to do a social topic, one that doesn't require us to get into the weeds of the tax and legal statutes. I love those episodes too, because we get to get into why we play the game, the positive impact that we can have on people's lives while making money. I'm Siobhan Jones. I'm looking forward to meeting again next Monday, and I hope you are too.